When you look at the books in the New Testament of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, etc., you might think those are the guys who wrote those chapters, but for all kinds of reasons, that's not how it works. For one thing, the men who get the credit and like the sainthood, didn't write those books by themselves. And the Bible scholar Candida Moss says, in some meaningful ways, they didn't write at all. She says, hidden behind those well-known names are lots and lots of co-authors and collaborators who get no credit at all. And this revelation about all of this came to her not so long ago.
About, I'd say, 5 years ago now, I didn't realize it at the time, but I started to need reading glasses. I'd always been someone who had no problem working on a laptop, but now I just can't do it. So I started with an external monitor, and then I found myself sort of enlarging the view on PDF documents when I was writing. And eventually, I realized, oh, I need reading glasses. That's what these headaches mean. And I wondered to myself, well, how do people do this in the ancient world? I'm a scholar. If I had lived 2,000 years ago, what would I have done? Because glasses have only existed for about 1,000 years. And the answer was so obvious. I should have known this already. Not just that they used other people, but that they use primarily enslaved people. Often young people, because their senses were so keen, and we have ancient sources talking about that. And for me, this was sort of a light bulb moment, which it shouldn't have been, because I've written books on disability before, and I've thought about it quite a lot. And you would have thought at some point in my graduate education, this would have come up. Someone would have said to me, you know, when people say they're reading or writing, they're often using other people to do that because they can't do it themselves. But it never had come up. Once I realized that, and I started digging into the people doing this work, I realized, wow, there are a lot of other people involved in this. Why haven't we been talking about it? And I just wanted to know a lot more. As I was digging into it, what I realized is just how widespread the phenomenon was and also how much work people were doing. I think lots of people today, somewhat inaccurately, think that ancient secretaries are just doing the sort of the same thing that a tape recorder might do today. You know, they're just recording what an author would say. But as I looked into it, I realized, oh, that's impossible. They couldn't possibly have been doing that. They are influencing the text. And because I was initially thinking with people who have disabilities, I thought, well, how would the author check that what they had said had been written down precisely? If they struggle to read and write because of vision loss or arthritis, how would they be able to confirm that nothing had been changed? And I realized that actually it was in the job of the secretary to change things, to improve them, to edit them. And so I thought, well, maybe they're making important interventions in the text. And what would those be? And we can say, oh, well, maybe they're just small, but I'm writing about the Bible. And, you know, no text is as pored over as the Bible. People really scrutinize these words very carefully. They want to know exactly what do they mean. Prepositions turn into new denominations of Christianity. And so this was all important. There's no such thing as a small change. And it was clear to me that they have the potential to make those kinds of changes. The question was, were they, and how do we know if they were?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Candida Moss is joining us to talk about her new book. It's called God's Ghostwriters. And not only does it take into account all the invisible hands, she says, shaped Christian doctrine, but it challenges some conventional ideas about the Bible as speaking in one voice with this pure ethical clarity. But we started the conversation with the Apostle Paul and his masterwork in the New Testament, the Epistle to the Romans.
All scholars that I know of agree that Paul wrote Romans. But this is a really stunning thing that we all say, because Romans 16:22 has this verse that reads, "I, Tertius, who wrote this letter," and then it has his greetings to the people in Rome. It quite clearly says that Tertius wrote the letter. And in fact, you can find medieval manuscripts that say that Paul and Tertius wrote the letter. So they wrote it together. Tertius did the writing. Paul dictated it, we assume. But it's not just Paul. And in fact, to say that it's just Paul is to change what Paul says.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because this is a theologically consequential text. And it really matters who produces it. It really matters what they intended when they used words. This is one of the most influential books in human history. Mm. And Paul must have co-written it with Tertius.
Yeah.
And there are other places in the Pauline epistles where he refers to having written bits of a letter. You know, he says in Galatians that he's writing a section of it with very large letters towards the end. He says that, which implies someone else wrote the rest of it. Huh. And even how Paul starts his letters, often the letters are from Paul and Timothy. But you wouldn't know that from how we talk about it.
Mm.
So I think it raises questions. And obviously, I'm sure for people who are Christian, troubling questions about who wrote this. Is it really Paul? What does this mean? Although, if you're invested in the idea that these texts ultimately come from God, then it doesn't really matter that there's another person involved. That shouldn't be the problem. The question should be, why aren't we talking about them?
Mm. Let me ask you something you mentioned early on in an author's note in the book about how history challenges an historian and how difficult it can be to, as you put it, you know, speak for people who are long dead. So it requires rigor and vigilance, you know, to get it right, you mentioned. But you also say this process requires reading into the gaps. What do you mean when you say a form of history telling requires imagination? That's another way you put it.
Yeah. What I mean by filling in the gaps is, I know that Tertius exists, or I know that these people are working, but I don't have any access to what happened because I'm not a time traveler and I can't go back in time. And so when I try to do this, I don't want to just sort of make something up. I want to do it responsibly. So what I did in writing the book that I'd never done before, and I really wish I had, is I read really widely, not just in ancient history and classics, which I normally do. I didn't just look at ancient archaeological materials, which I also normally do. I read widely in the history of labor, especially clerical workers, to see what do they say about why they make changes to texts, or what evidence do we have from the medieval period when you have two people writing together about who did what? And when I tried to imagine my way into the lives of these enslaved people, I read really widely in ancient medicine, ancient archaeology. I read scientific journals about what happens to someone's hands if they are writing all the time. And I also read pretty widely in the history of Atlantic slavery, where people had done this before. I was sort of borrowing those methods. And then I document everything I do in a website that accompanies the book. And the reason I did that was I wanted people to be able to check what I had written if they wanted to. I think if you were to look at any scholarship, you would find moments of imagination and assumptions that were being made, assumptions just being the same thing. I just wanted to do this in a transparent way.
There's this larger question that may be challenging for believers, and that is whether the earliest version of Christianity, you know, the Jesus movement, whether it condemned slavery and, you know, preached equality in the sight of God, because it seems that that isn't actually reality. This notion of egalitarianism isn't really in the reality of those, of the early experience of being a Christian. Is that right to say?
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of people who instantly say, well, you know, in Galatians 3, he says, in Christ there's no slave or free, which seems to erase those differences. But then you have to read the whole of the Bible and the whole of the New Testament. And the fact of the matter is, Paul, who wrote Galatians, never condemns slavery. Jesus tells numerous stories in which you have a parable, and there are enslaved people who end up being beaten or killed, and they're sort of narrative plot devices. At no point does anyone in the New Testament say, we should get rid of slavery, we should abolish it, you can't have enslaved workers anymore, which is why Christians continued to have enslaved workers for a very long period of time. This makes us really uncomfortable. There are lots of people who would prefer not to talk about this, but I don't think anyone's well served by papering over this aspect of history. We have to face what the Bible says head on. We can't just sort of pretend it says what we want it to say.
Well, you write about how the New Testament just kind of acknowledges slavery as this fact of life, and in fact includes instructions for enslaved people to basically accept the way they're being treated. I wanted you to say a little bit more about that, because I think it puts another spin on the idea of someone being considered faithful. That's kind of a fraught word, I guess, in this context.
Yeah. So the instructions about being obedient come from 1 Peter. And here the audience is told that if they're being beaten unjustly by their enslaver, they should accept that and think of themselves as suffering like Christ. And I have to say, this idea that the idea that's captured there, the kernel of thought that if you suffer, that you're like Christ, it's called imitatio Christi in Roman Catholic and medieval tradition. That's been profoundly meaningful for me, because I was someone who was very sick as a child, and I really like that idea. Because I didn't realize when I was a child how oppressive that is, to tell enslaved people that they should accept unjust beatings. And I didn't know that actual enslavers had used that as a justification for their behavior. There's this idea that we're all really familiar with, if we know anything about Christianity or religion at all, that someone who's a Christian is faithful, that they're faithful to Christ. It's a founding idea in Christianity.
Right.
And that idea of fidelity in the Bible, in ancient Greek and in Latin, it's more like loyalty. And it's the preeminent quality of an enslaved person. They have to be faithful or loyal to their enslaver. So whenever we talk about fidelity to God, which in the New Testament demands a lot of you, you should leave your family and your property, give up your life if necessary. What we're really talking about, that model is intimately connected to an idea that enslaved people should do that. And enslaved people, of course, did regularly do that, because when they were taken captive, they did leave their homes and their families and their property, which were all taken from them. So when we think about fidelity, we need to be aware that that language is sort of intertwined with something else, something dark. And when we encourage people to accept suffering, we need to know the history of that idea and why it's quite morally problematic.
Well, here's another one of those things that I think may trouble some Christians. You mentioned that enslavement is kind of you say it's the central framing device for the relationship between human beings and God in the New Testament.
Well, in all of the parables in which God is sort of a king or, you know, a monarch or an enslaver, all of the workers sent out are enslaved. In Paul, we're told to be faithful to Christ, that all of this language of being set free in Christ and how we will be adopted by God at the resurrection. enslavement to God is the central frame for thinking about our relationship to God. That makes sense because it's the biggest power differential that they have in the ancient world. You know, a monarch and an enslaved person. That's the biggest gap. And so it makes sense that people would use it. I think what we have to be aware of is that that's not just a metaphor for everyone. You know, I think some people are more comfortable with it because it's just a metaphor to them. But for other people, that really triggers something very deep and profound. And we might want to think about how we're using it, how casually we use it, and whether it really serves us well.
Let's talk more about the role that Tertius, in this case, played as a ghostwriter for the Bible, and I guess by extension, the role that was played by other enslaved, you know, scribes and writers. There's this traditional image of Paul writing alone, but very occasionally, if Tertius is included in this telling, there's the image of, you know, Paul, as you say, fervently pacing the room. He's trying to get the right word out, and then you have Tertius just basically sitting there, kind of acting like a stenographer, just taking down what Paul is, you know, what sort of brilliance is coming out of Paul's mouth. But is that how it worked? Because you've described what's going on between Tertius and Paul as a collaborative writing project. He wasn't just a stenographer. So how do you think it worked?
So ancient shorthand, ancient stenography is a little different than stenography today. It's very bare bones. So when you take down someone's words, you don't have as many symbols as you do in modern shorthand. And the system was kind of adapted by individuals, which is why we can't read so much ancient shorthand even today. Huh. It's very ambiguous. People have said that since we decoded ancient shorthand. They said it's very ambivalent. And what that means is that the person who is translating Paul's words into shorthand isn't actually taking them down completely precisely. They're taking them down, but it's work of translation, and then they have to expand it later. And as an ancient secretary, the job of a secretary is to improve what the person said. I don't know about you, but when I'm speaking off the cuff, I regularly say things sort of in a slightly awkward way. They might be slightly grammatically incorrect. And if they were being taken down by a stenographer, it would be their job to improve what I said. And we have examples of ancient papyri where the scribe definitely did that. And we can tell that they did that because they got tired and they decided to stop. And, you know, and suddenly the style changes.
Yeah.
So we know that secretaries are making changes, that they are improving texts. And in Paul's case, he was regularly dictating letters from prison. It's not clear even how much time he would have had to review what he had written. It's not clear that he wouldn't have sort of given a broad outline. We have examples of letters being dictated. And the person who's the author of the letter says, write a letter, and this is what it should say. But they don't sit there and dictate it word for word. We can imagine in something like Romans, Paul's very hands-on. But Tertius is an expert. He's very well-educated in comparison to most people. And for all we know, he makes little tweaks here and there that improve the letter. That's supposed to be his job. But it means that he's doing authorial work. He's collaborating with Paul on that letter.
So it's fair to say then that some of the, I guess, the elegance of the writing, or even the powerful emotion of Paul, that letter, Romans, let's say, to be specific, was Tertius, not necessarily Paul. Is that right?
Yes, I think that is right. No one's mindless. This isn't mindless work.
Candida Moss. She's a professor of theology at the University of Birmingham. Her latest book is called God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians in the Making of the Bible. You're listening to Radio West. is it accurate to call an enslaved person a Christian? Let me explain the question for listeners. One of the things you point out in the book is that we don't really know what kind of a choice an enslaved person would have had about their religion. Say something about that, if you would.
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. So we have all kinds of enslaved people referred to in early Christian literature as members of the Jesus movement. And we just call them Christians. But we don't really know anything about the circumstances of their conversion and baptism. Many people would have been forced to convert to Christianity. Their enslaver converted, so they converted and were baptized as a result. And this isn't to single out Christianity. This is everyone in the ancient world. But this is an important point to note, because we shouldn't just sort of straightforwardly say, well, they're Christian, because we don't know if they had any choice. And we don't know what was happening in their mind when they were being baptized. So we have to be careful about it.
Well, an important reality was slavery was everywhere in that part of the world at the time. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how prevalent it was, and also explain, as you do in the book, that it wasn't based on race, which is a kind of a necessarily, I guess that was a construct, of course, that's a concept that came much later. But talk a little bit about that, like the type of enslavement that's playing out.
Yeah, so the Roman Empire is one of maybe five societies throughout recorded history that was really structured on the ownership of enslaved people. A lot of work was being done by enslaved people. About one in five people were enslaved. And most of those enslaved people, they found themselves in this position either because they were captured as prisoners of war, maybe in very rare cases they were kidnapped or their family ran into debt, and so they had to either sell themselves or their parents sold them into slavery. Some rare cases, families couldn't raise children, so they exposed them, and those children were then picked up by slave traders. Or they were born into the household of an enslaver, and they were born of an enslaved mother. And what this means is that Roman slavery is not about race in the same way as later iterations of slavery were about this kind of particular configuration of what race is. Because, of course, as you say, it's a construct. But there is this kind of complicated relationship between conquest and biology, which is always local. That means that sometimes you'll have sort of groups of people who all look fairly similar to one another who will be enslaved at the same time.
Let's talk about an enslaved child you write about, a boy named Alexamenos. His life is revealed to us because of this cruel bit of graffiti that was written on a wall. Tell us this story, if you would.
So it's called the Alexamenos graffiti, and it's found on the wall of a schoolroom in Rome on the Palatine Hill. And this is a place where a lot of imperial palaces were. This is sort of, you know, this is where the upper echelon of Roman society were. And in the schoolroom, enslaved children were educated, and it is covered with graffiti. The Romans don't seem to care about graffiti the way we do. They don't really make any efforts to get rid of it. Yeah. And these children, often they're writing inscriptions about how they're going to leave the schoolroom and they're going to move on to better things. There are a lot of jokes about gladiators because basically they like sports. And they also make fun of each other. And the Alexamenos graffiti is an example of that loss category. A child, let's not call him a friend, a child in the same schoolroom as Alexamenos has pictured Alexamenos worshipping his god. And his god, it's not very pretty, that's written underneath it. His god in this case is a man on a cross being crucified who has a donkey's head. And both the man on the cross and Alexamenos are wearing the clothing worn by enslaved people. And all scholars agree that the man who's being crucified is supposed to be Jesus. And we think this because we have a lot of sources that talk about Jesus being depicted with a donkey head And that's probably because they were sort of making fun of his kind of lowly, servile origins. And so you have this child who's being educated in Rome and who was clearly a follower of Jesus in some way. And he's being made fun of by a classmate for that, in this vivid image that this is actually our earliest portrait of Jesus, comes from this schoolroom. And this is a brief glimpse at his life. We never hear from him again. But he's exactly the kind of person we should imagine taking dictation from Christian authors, copying texts, maybe reading them aloud. And it also exposes one of the stark differences between Roman slavery and more recent forms of slavery. I think many people will be surprised to learn that Romans do educate enslaved children, because in other periods of history, enslaved people have been denied an education and actually punished physically for trying to get one, because Atlantic enslavers knew that education was power. But the reason why they didn't need enslaved literate workers, they didn't need enslaved people who could read and write, is because they had the printing press and they had electricity and they had glasses. But for the Romans, who had none of those things, they had to educate children like Count Semenos to do their work.
Another thing about that little Alexamenos graffito is that it shows how crucifixion was a punishment, you say, reserved for those on the lowest rungs of society. So crucifixion was associated with enslaved people.
That's right. I think we've sort of grown inured to crucifixion. If you go to church, you know it's a thing, you hear about it, you read the Bible, you hear the description. But the brutality of it is sort of gone. And its kind of cultural and social connotations are also gone. I learned when I first started learning about the Bible in more detail that crucifixion was for traitors and people who were seen as threats to the Roman Empire. And that is true. But that's sort of the minority. It was largely used for enslaved people as a warning to other enslaved people not to rebel. Because remember, there are so many of them. They do, in many instances, have the numbers. So it's reserved for servile people. There is, in fact, lots of evidence of people using expressions like "go hang on a cross" as an insult to an enslaved person. So it's particularly associated with slavery.
Well, one of the things you write about in the book is that Mark's telling of the really brutal death of Jesus, his crucifixion, might reveal something about the co-author of Mark, you know, the ghostwriter of Mark, that, as you put it, this enslaved person did not draw a veil over the unpleasantness of the crucifixion.
That's right. The crucifixion in Mark is brutal. Yeah. Jesus does not seem in control, and the author will not let you escape that. And when you think about an enslaved co-author helping produce this text, the Gospel of Mark, we usually say, is written around 70, after the destruction of Jerusalem. A lot of Jewish people were crucified then. Many more were just killed or enslaved. And for those people, they never really had a chance to mourn, to feel their own losses, because they were living in the midst of trauma. And the story of the death of Jesus in Mark, that doesn't, like other stories of the deaths of heroes, it doesn't pretend that the hero was in control. It doesn't pretend it didn't hurt. It gives people space to feel, to see the brutality. It makes visible violence that ancient society and history has sort of concealed. And I can imagine that for the ancient co-author and for ancient readers of this text, it was very powerful to read your experiences in this story, to feel that that was your story that you could really connect to.
In the book, there's this, you give this kind of this rereading of one of the stories in the New Testament through the filter of this reality of enslavement. It's the story of Jesus healing this paralytic man Will you take us through this story and talk about the lessons that you see here? Your rethinking of this story, I think, is remarkable.
Thank you. I'm proud of it. I'm also sort of embarrassed that I didn't notice it before. And in the story, four men bring a paralyzed man on some kind of stretcher or bed to Jesus. There's not enough room for them to get into the house where Jesus was. So they climb on top of the house and they start taking apart the roof to let the man down into the room. And there are two kinds of people in the ancient world who get carried. People who cannot walk because of an impairment, or people who are very wealthy who were carried around by enslaved people because it was just more convenient for them. They didn't get their feet dirty. Mm. And then, of course, there's this invisible third category, which is people who were both. They couldn't walk, but they were also carried around because they were rich and they could afford that. They weren't sort of stuck in that place. And in the story, in Greek, we don't know who the four people are. The way Greek works, you don't even have to identify them as people. And I, like generations of readers, just assumed that they were the man's friends.
Yeah.
But there was no reason to think that. They're not called friends. And then they dismantle the roof and lower down the man. And then the word for the bed that the man is lying on, it could mean just a simple mat, or it could mean like something much more elaborate, like a beautiful kind of litter. And the fact that there are four of them might lead us to think that it's the latter, that it's kind of a heftier litter. And they let him down into the room. Jesus looks at them, at the four men, and he looks at the man and gets into a little bit of a spat with sort of the people who are debating with him. And he says to the man, "Your sins are forgiven. Take up your bed and walk." And if we think of the four people who brought him as enslaved, this is a whole different story. Because now Jesus has forgiven the man's sins. We don't know what they are. Maybe he shouldn't have dismantled a neighbor's roof. Maybe he shouldn't have been using enslaved people in the way that he was. But then he says to him, do not just pick up yourself, hop back up on the litter and be carried around again. Instead, he's insisting, you do your own work. Stop exploiting the other people. It's amazing that there's a pause in the story where Jesus directs our attention to the enslaved people who had carried the man. And now the story that was about friendship and about going above and beyond for your friends now reads as a story in which Jesus subtly condemns the enslaver and tells him to do his own work. It's a sort of subversion of the structures of slavery. And it was astonishing to me that I had never noticed that the language of friendship that had been imported into the story wasn't that. That wasn't what was happening.
That's the biblical scholar Candida Moss. Her new book is God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians in the Making of the Bible. You're listening to Radio West. This passage in Philippians in the New Testament where Paul says that Jesus transitions from the form of a god to the form of a slave at his birth. And you raise the question of whether that's more than a metaphor. And it makes me wonder, is there any reason to believe Jesus was enslaved?
I don't think we quite have the evidence for that. Hmm. What we have is Paul saying that, and then we have all of these hints throughout the Gospels. So you have Jesus being crucified is the biggest. It was enslaved people who were crucified. So that might already lead you to think perhaps he was enslaved. If you read the earliest Gospel, the Gospel of Mark, Jesus doesn't actually have a human father.
Yeah.
There's no reference to Joseph. And I think an ancient reader would look at that and assume, well, if you don't have a legal father, you're at least illegitimate, if not actually enslaved, because enslaved people couldn't have legal fathers. And then he does all of these things that sound, in ancient terms, a bit slavish. So he speaks in fables, or as we call them, parables. Mm. He sort of meanders around, and meandering is has throughout history has been seen as a slavish form of movement. He doesn't go directly to Jerusalem to die. He sort of takes a very circuitous route. And he doesn't know the timing of the day of judgment when God will return, which is interesting because in ancient manuals for running your farms, the distant enslaver has an overseer who knows everything except for when the enslaver will return. Hmm. Why don't they know that? So that everybody has to keep working. So they never tell their overseer enslaved workers what they are doing, when they are going to return, so that everybody keeps up the work. And this might explain why Jesus doesn't know the timing of the day of judgment, because he's that kind of enslaved figure. This doesn't add up to the conclusion that Jesus himself was definitely enslaved. Hmm. I think what it suggests is that the co-authors of these texts were creating space for enslaved people to see themselves in Jesus.
So I want to be careful and sensitive with this question, but you write that the absence of a legal father for Jesus might suggest that his mother, Mary, was enslaved, or possibly a sex worker. Now, as you say, you mention you're not suggesting, historically speaking, Mary was a sex worker, or for that matter, an enslaved woman, but that, as you said, the Gospels create this kind of possibility for that kind of interpretation. Will you say something about that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I also feel hesitant in expressing this because of how sensitive it is.
Right.
So there is this idea in antiquity that people who are not Christian would throw around, which is that Jesus was the son of a Roman soldier, or his mother was a sex worker of some kind, or at least promiscuous. That gets bandied around, and you have hints of that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke in different ways. And it makes people very uncomfortable, both because there's a long line of tradition in mainstream Protestantism and Roman Catholicism that Mary was a virgin when she conceived Jesus, and in Roman Catholicism that she never engaged in sexual relations for the duration of her life. There's this close association of sexual purity and holiness there, yeah, encoded in that idea. So obviously those are foundational ideas for members of those denominations. And I'm not suggesting, just to say it again, I'm not suggesting that historically she was a sex worker, but there are these hints, there's this possibility, as you said. I think what we have to ask ourselves is, why is that there? After the Jewish War, the first Jewish War, many women would have found themselves widowed and alone. There are a lot of women who are unaccompanied in the first gospel, the Gospel of Mark. They don't seem to have male protectors. And at the end of the first century, when the gospel is being written, there are a lot of people, a lot of women who didn't have protectors, who would have been forced into desperate situations to make ends meet. This might have been their only option. And whether or not people want to morally condemn sex workers, I think everyone should feel the power and desperation of people in that period, of people forced into sex work because they have no other alternative to feed their children, to support themselves, because they weren't trained in professions. And I think what we see here is just a possibility for those people. Many enslaved women, even if they lived in households rather than brothels, were subject to sexual violence on a daily basis. They had no choice in the matter. Hmm. And by presenting Mary in this way, by having characters like this, the evangelists, the enslaved co-authors are creating space for them, this kind of gentle view that they can be accepted, that they can see themselves, that they haven't been outcast or shunned by God.
I want to come back to Alexamenos or children or enslaved people like him, because you mentioned the long days and short nights probably took a toll on someone like Alexamenos, physically, you say, and emotionally. I mean, emotionally, you know, you mentioned how he probably had to suppress his own emotions, his own hiccups, his sense of hunger, that the fear of being an enslaved person was relentless. So there's that emotional part. But also, let's say something about the physical toll that this took. Because as you've said, this is a book about labor. So let's talk about how difficult that labor was. And one thing that really struck me, you mentioned, I mean, people have this image of these enslaved, you know, writers and scribes with desks. They didn't have desks, or they didn't use desks, we don't think. And it complicates the idea of doing this work, because it seemed incredibly taxing physically.
Yes, it was taxing. We do think that if you're doing this kind of secretarial work, well, that's much better than working in the mines or a mill or on the farms. And that's probably true. Not that it's a competition. But when you think about secretarial labor, there's the emotional violence of being hypervigilant all the time, of being able to be called upon at any moment to do work, of never quite being able to be comfortable. But then there's the physical discomfort. I think anyone who's ever taken a written exam, like a long written exam where you have to write very quickly, will recall, you have to kind of shake out your hand. After about half an hour, you start doing it more and more because it hurts. Mm-hmm. And you have calluses on your fingers from writing with a pen all the time, which is how I grew up. And when you bend over the writing that's positioned on your knee because you don't have a desk because you live in antiquity, that's uncomfortable. Over time, you actually start to walk slightly lopsidedly. I spoke to doctors about this. Tell me what would happen to you. You might even get a slight hunchback from doing it. And then there would be the pain in the hands and arms. Even in the 19th century, scribes and clerks, they would complain of something called Scrivener's palsy. It's from writing by hand, and it could actually, they said, cause paralysis in your arm if you kind of push through it. Wow. Anyone who has repetitive strain injury, carpal tunnel, knows exactly how painful this is, but they only know the beginnings of it. They don't know what it's like when people continue to make you read and write long after you're in pain, because none of us would do that. And so this is very hard work. This is deeply physical and deeply uncomfortable.
There's a story you tell in the book. This is from the early second century. And the way you tell it, there's this person who is preparing to read the story of Mark at a Roman dinner party. You give this person a name, Felix. He's enslaved. And Felix has to sort of create a more, I guess, dramatic ending for the gospel, because it just kind of fizzles out.
Yeah. So the story I create is sort of a Roman dinner party. This is when a lot of reading took place. And Felix is a reader. And because of the way manuscripts were written, they didn't have breaks between the words. He had to prepare. Yeah. And so I picture Felix preparing to read this text. It's short. You can read it in a whole evening. And he gets to the end and he's like, oh no. Because it does fizzle out. It ends just with the women running away for they were afraid. But in Greek, for is the last word of the sentence. Mm-hmm. And he can imagine that everyone's going to look at him and wonder what's coming next. Because it doesn't sound like the end of the book at all. It doesn't sound like the ending of any book. And so I imagine that Felix thinks I should write a sort of more dignified conclusion to this text. And so he pulls together stories from other gospels, and he writes what in the manuscripts of the Bible, it's called the longer ending of Mark. And if you have a Bible and you look at it, you'll notice that verses 9 and following in chapter 16, the last chapter of the Gospel of Mark, are often put in sort of square brackets to signal that they're not in the original manuscript, depending on what version you're using. And what I'm trying to explain here is why some manuscripts have an ending that others don't.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some people are thinking, did she just make that up? The idea that Felix performed this text in a certain way, and there was another enslaved worker there who took it down, and that's why we have a different version. And I did just make that up. But what I would say is every academic attempt to explain the ending of Mark also has to make it up. So one popular theory is that Mark was writing the gospel. He gets arrested. Just when he gets there to that point of the women fleeing away, he gets arrested. He's confined for some period of time, and then he comes back. And when he writes it out again, he has this longer ending. So that too is imagination. But what I wanted to do in the story was to try and show the range of ways that our Bible came to be, the importance of the people who read the text aloud, the way they were in conversation with the people who were writing down the text and copying it, the very kind of vibrant way that the text of the New Testament came to be. I wanted to make visible the sort of lives of people who did read the Bible aloud, because most people were illiterate. They were so important. They were the faces of the gospel to most early Christians.
Let me ask you finally, how do you think this alters or affects the way believers use the Bible in their lives? And not just, you know, for worship, but moral guidance. Because one of the things you mention is this story, this reality of enslaved people, you know, in that time, but also involved in the creation of these texts, that forces people to confront a truth that is unsettling, that the meaning of the Bible is fluid. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Hopefully, what it changes is the very casual way that we talk about the language of slavery in the Bible. Hopefully, it gives us pause. It makes us think about the power dynamics of that, of who's being harmed by that language today. While the idea that the Bible's meaning is always fluid and constantly being reproduced by readings in antiquity and by the ways in which we interpret the text today can be unsettling, hopefully just as words on the page, it's unsettling. I mean, there are very violent stories in this text. This is a set of texts that does not condemn slavery, that has stories of genocide in it. So hopefully we were already unsettled, and thinking about enslaved workers should call us to think about how we're reading the story, where the enslaved workers might be, who does the work. When we think of the Last Supper, who prepared the food, who brought the food, who cleared it away? And I hope that ultimately we will think about our own worlds and what kinds of work we're not seeing today in the present, about the kinds of work that's visible to us that we prize, and about the kinds of work that we obscure and that people who read the book will think, maybe I should pay more attention to that as well.
Candida Moss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Candida Moss. She's a professor of theology at the University of Birmingham. Her latest book is called God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians in the Making of the Bible. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.